Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. 411 Teen is a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. 411 Teen provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that confront, intersect, and sometimes interrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield. Let's tap into the pulse of young folks. This edition of 411 Teen Talks Politics Rap. The Politics Rap team consists of teens with diverse political affiliations, all in the IB program at Rickards High School. The panel seeks to analyze and evaluate current national, state, and local politics. Joining me here at the roundtable, I'm always glad to have them. They're veterans, and I welcome them back. And you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, my name is Sonor Pradhan. I'm a graduating senior at Rickards High School.
And Sonor, what do you plan to do since you are a graduating senior? Do you have your plans made up, or what are you?
As of now, I'm going to be applying for an international exchange program that I'll be going for after graduation.
That sounds good.
I'm Jackson Burks, returning. Happy to be here. Thank you.
And Jackson, you're a graduating senior too. You tried to leave that out, huh? What are your plans?
I'm hoping to get a degree in economics from the University of Virginia.
Okay.
I'm Apoorva Srivastav. I'm a junior at Rickards right now.
And that's good. That means I'll have you another year. And yeah. I always value your opinions. So glad to have you around. When I say the city of Tallahassee and Leon County, what issues come to your mind? What are things that are of high concern for you? What raises your ire, so to speak, if there's anything?
Well, I think Tallahassee has a lot of problems with economic segregation. I think that's a big issue. And that, of course, ties into racial issues with a lot of minorities being tending to be in lower socioeconomic situations. So I think that would probably be the biggest problem facing Tallahassee right now is educating and incorporating different socioeconomic classes.
Do you have any suggestions that I would like? What I want to do is just address what you're saying, and then we'll move on. But do any of you have any suggestions as to how to address this economic segregation? Because the poverty rate is the census tract, 10.01 in South City, has a childhood poverty rate of 80.1%. Yet, we are giving lots of money. The CRA gives money to the DoubleTree Hotel and to the FSU Boosters, and it goes on and on and on. But these are not entities that really need the money. So I'd like to hear you respond to that since you've raised that issue. What do you think? How do you think we can address it?
Well, we kind of talked about this last time, but, you know, Donald Trump called Tallahassee, though, the most corrupt city. But
that's
I think that's kind of taking it out of proportion. But there is definitely a bureaucratic problem with the way that we're handling the economic state of Tallahassee. And I think that, you know, in an ideal sense, if we were able to legitimize the genuine care for our community, we'd see improvements, but lobbying within the government kind of constricts and puts bureaucratic binding on the amount of social reform we can actually do. So,
yeah.
I mean, definitely. I guess a little more organization can go a longer way in this situation, where we can get people in here that really advocate for the rights for the people in poverty. They can get that money, right? Mm-hmm. And the money right now is obviously going to those boosters, the DoubleTree Hotel. And what the people that are giving the money away are thinking probably are, how can this benefit me? They're not really thinking about others in this situation and what the future is really going to look like. They're only thinking about, okay, it's the present right now. It's what's impacting me. But in the future, they're really setting a lot of things up for failure. Mm-hmm. So one of the best things to do would to have people in there who are empathetic, who feel for other people, who realize that I'm not going to be here in like 40 to 50 years. It's going to be other people. It's going to be those kids who are in poverty.
Good points. I always like to hear your perspective. Okay. And as you look at what's going on in Tallahassee, what would you identify as issues?
Something that I've really noticed is, so I went to Conley mm-hmm. and I went to Fairview. When I was at those schools, they were excellent schools. I received a great education from their really good foundation. But what I've noticed is, as I've graduated from those schools, I've seen the newer years that come in. It seems as if the quality of education is getting less and less. And I can see that in my high school, too, where in my brother's year 4 or 5 years ago, he's graduated now. Mm-hmm. I could see that when he went to school, his peers, his teachers, they enjoyed teaching, they enjoyed learning, but now it seems as if like a lot of my friends, a lot of my peers see it as a chore, and that overall is impacting the education that they receive.
Okay. Comments?
I don't think we can really directly associate a correlation between the year in which, you know, students have gone through the IB track or any school, as a matter mm-hmm. of fact, and combine that with their enjoyment for learning, so to speak, or the outlook that that person had mm-hmm. on education. Like, I'm sure that, like, in a provost brother's year, like, people might have valued their education more, enjoyed going to school. And sure, like, over years, like, it's kind of inevitable that teachers get tired of monotony. But I think that, you know, some teachers and some students at Rickards currently do really enjoy being in that environment. So I don't think there's really a claim for the correlation between that.
Okay. How do we address these issues, though? Because what you're saying, education is deteriorating, okay? Mm-hmm. And I've heard from other students here in Leon County the same type of comments that you're talking about, where the teachers do not seem as enthusiastic. It seems mm-hmm. like they're kind of going through a rote kind of thing. Students are not as eager, as open, as receptive, whatever words we want to learning. And so, you know, we may not have done any statistical studies on it, but it is there, okay?
Sure.
And I'm just wondering if you have any, you all are in it, you know, I'm generations removed from it. If you have any insights as to how we address these issues. I mean, education is an issue nationwide, not just Tallahassee or the state of Florida. And for you who are there, what do you see? What do you think would make a difference?
Well, from my personal experience, I can't speak to these claims because I don't find these claims to be true. I mean, I haven't seen any statistics, and I personally haven't experienced this. I mean, I'm not super aware of the education specifically at each school and their letter grades, for example. I personally haven't experienced this, so I would just caution these claims.
Okay, granted, I understand that's where you're coming from, but if you know, if you're recognizing, you know, whether we've done a statistical study, what I'm asking you all is, you're there. What suggestions might you make? Okay.
Yeah. I think one thing that we hear our teachers say a lot, and it's kind of a very heavily stigmatized statement, is, you know, teaching for the test. Mm-hmm. And I think this is kind of a huge problem in Florida schools. We have huge amounts of money put into standardized testing. And then if you're an IB student, you have IB testing. If you're not an IB student, you have AP testing. IB students still take AP exams. And it's all these exams that, and these numbers that you're given based on your results, that put so much pressure not only on the students but also the mm-hmm. teachers to teach in such a way that students aren't supposed to learn the information as much as they are supposed to learn how to pass this test. And I think mm-hmm. that creates a lot of kind of unhappiness with the way that teachers conduct their classes, because they want to do things that are more interesting, they want to do things that are more engaging, but they know they have this strict syllabus that they have to teach, where, you know, students are basically required to memorize bullet points rather than creating a foundation for really enjoying a subject like they could be.
Okay. And I think those are valid points. Hopefully the right people are listening to the program. And what would you identify
As a problem in Tallahassee?
Yeah, there's some of the issues in Tallahassee.
Tallahassee kind of has this really consistently poor statistic of violence, especially gun violence. There was a shooting in Magnolia not too far back, but...
And the yoga studio.
The shooting in the yoga studio, right? Yeah, that was a few miles away from my house. Yeah.
Right. Okay. I think
it's ridiculous that not only do we have to deal with this, but that this is kind of a problem that's not being addressed very well. It's kind of one of those things where it occurs. You hear the government and influential politicians say, like, my thoughts and prayers go out for this community. Uh-huh. And then we don't see advancement in the government. And I'm not saying that it's an easy advancement to do. I'm not saying that it's something that, you know, we can all fix with a snap of a finger. But I just wish that we would get more conversation about it in politics. So.
Okay.
Tallahassee is statistically has a bigger problem with gun violence a lot of the time and violent crimes than other cities of similar size in Florida. So it's definitely a problem that I think it needs to be addressed. There are a lot of ways you could go about it. I would always come back to, I think it has a lot to do with economic divides in the city. And a lot, as you mentioned, a lot of, like, the south side of Tallahassee is very poor. And that's where you have a lot of your crime happening. At the end of the day, it comes back to enriching and educating these communities to kind of prevent that and move children and the next generation away from crime as a lifestyle.
Okay.
Yeah, going off what you said, we need to focus on how this is going to impact the future of our society, how the students that are in school right now, the kids that are about to start school or just have graduated from school, they're largely the ones that are being impacted by this, mm-hmm. by the high violence rates. And the fact that I could be walking down a street and a shooting could be happening five blocks away from me, that's something that scares me to a level beyond that I can comprehend. So the main thing that we can do is just, you know, educate the younger generation, educate ourselves on what we can do to advocate for our government to step in and do something about it.
We have two hospitals here in Tallahassee, and recently they received their rating on patient safety. This rating is done by LeapFrog, and the rating was very disturbing. TMH received a D, and Capital Regional Medical Center received a C. You're tuned into 411 Teen. We're going to take a brief break, but we will return shortly. If you're just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen, and this edition is dealing with the IB students. We're working with IB students, and this is Politics Wrap. We were just talking about the conditions and the ratings that the two hospitals received here. TMH received a D, and Capital Regional Medical Center received a C, and we were talking about your response to that. Okay.
Well, that kind of doesn't seem like a shocker to me.
Oh, okay.
I've been volunteering over there over the summer for 2 years now at both Capital Regional Medical Center and TMH. And some of the stuff that I've seen going on there, both in like the upper levels and how the hospitals run day-to-day basis and how they train their volunteers, is some things really did concern me. Where I remember one personal anecdote where I was working in the ER as a volunteer, and my job was to talk to any patients that would be coming in and write down what their symptoms or what they were feeling, and then I'd tell the people in the back, okay, what's going on? And there's this one specific day where a person came in with really bad chest pains, which is usually a sign of like something wrong with your heart, or like a sign of maybe this guy's almost about to have a heart attack. And something that I won't forget about what he said was that he went to TMH and they said because of insurance, they wouldn't take him.
Oh, TMH said that?
Yeah. And he came over to Capital Regional and Capital Region said, okay, we'll get you back there stat. And that type of thing I know happens in both places, where someone's healthcare isn't up to date or someone doesn't have the financial, you know, situation, and they're over here struggling, like, you should make that a second. You should make that a second priority.
Yeah, well, I strongly agree with you on that.
I mean, yeah, in the United States, it a lot of times comes back to the insurance issue. But yeah, I mean, that's very concerning that our two medical centers are poorly ran, at least in that.
Well, this is on patient safety.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And with patient safety, just let me identify, we're talking about infections particularly. That's what they were looking at. They were looking at infections from following procedures, infections in the bloodstream, overuse of antibiotics. So, you know, just so I clarify exactly what this was referring to.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's very concerning for our community sometimes.
Yeah, so especially in consideration to the overuse of antibiotics, I think that's really interesting. Normally, you know, we always learn in biology that the prescription of antibiotics is risky because it can create the chance that if a infection or a certain bacteria survives, that it'll become immune to the to what we're currently using, and then it'll create an even larger problem. So we're not supposed to overprescribe that. And, you know, a lot of problem with that is, in order to profit as a doctor, in order for these hospitals to profit and kind of help more people, they're required to sell prescription medication. And that's one of the ways of increasing the revenue of a hospital. And so it kind of pushes us into this dilemma of do we do what we can as a hospital to increase profit to help more people? Or do we do what we can as a hospital to save the people that we have now and not think about, you know, the long-term goal? So I can understand the problem that these hospitals are facing. I don't think that what they're doing is proper procedure or the right thing, but I also don't think it's as clear-cut as that. So,
Well, I can say that TMH is a not-for-profit hospital, and Capital Regional is a for-profit hospital.
Right.
So that may make, you know, a little bit of a difference there. But let's move on to the state. And I guess there are a lot of things to identify. I'll start by identifying, we can talk about the governor's race. Comments, what was your response to it, Gillum and DeSantis?
I'd focus on the debate that they had.
Okay.
Something that I see not only in this governor's race debate, but also in, you know, any type of debate, any presidential debate, any debate for any other governors in any other state, is where, you know, they're asked a question, but it very quickly turns into a mudslinging competition. Watching the debate that night, I remember trying to go back and reflect on what I saw, and I really didn't remember any of them talking about what they've done and how they're going to benefit Florida. They just talked about, you know, you did this, you did that. And every time they were asked a question, they would be like, you know, I'd answer this, but let's focus on what they did. And both parties were at fault. It wasn't as if but one was talking about how they were actually going to do something and the other person was only mudslinging. It was both parties. And that's something that I really don't like when it comes to these races. It's where the person who can get the most dirt on the other person is probably going to be the one who
And
wins.
They don't answer the questions that are posed to them. They skirt, at least that's from my perspective, they skirt it, you know, and they never answer the question. You're like, what does that have to do with the question that was posed to you?
Yeah. At constant times during the debate, two of the most popular things, DeSantis would always bring up the corruption charges against
Gillum,
and then always against DeSantis, the Don't Monkey This Up ad would always be brought up, and nothing that really mattered popped up, and like how they're going to affect schooling or how they're going to talk about the budget of Florida.
And that seems to be the case across the board, you know. I mean, not just here in the state of Florida. I think at the national level you still see that. So I appreciate your comments. Well taken.
Yeah, I generally don't watch the discussions. I usually find them very productive. But I personally didn't vote in this election. I was a bigger fan of Gillum. I do think he is a little inexperienced with the job. He was a mayor of a city with a lot of problems. Now, not a lot of those problems, I think, can be purely blamed on him. But I think for his political career, he should have waited. That was shown. He did lose. But I would have liked to see him with more experience before he went for that. And DeSantis, a common theme among a lot of Republican candidates is not offering a solution, but denying the problem. Mm-hmm. So for gun control, DeSantis has a very, we don't need to really do anything about gun control. It's not that big of a deal. So I personally was a bigger fan of Gillum, though I didn't find either of the candidates super appealing. Mm-hmm. What I found more concerning about the past election was a lot of the amendments that were passed. If I'm correct, in the state of Florida, you now have to have a supermajority to alter the tax plan, which is, the most concerning, because that makes it so much harder for whatever party to have a majority that has a majority in the state to change the taxes in the state. Kansas, I believe it was Kansas, passed a similar thing, and they have had huge problems fixing their taxes over the past 10 years, because even if the Democrats or the Republicans come out on top after the election, they don't have a supermajority. They don't have more than, I believe, 66%. So that was most concerning to me. Some of the other ones were less concerning, but I thought some of the amendments in the election didn't belong in the state constitution. Dog racing and vaping, things like that in our constitution, I don't think are really necessary. But that also stems kind of from the American point of view of how to use a constitution. But that can be very different from country to country.
Okay. I think one thing we can look at this election looking forward is, you know, Florida for the presidential election is famously a swing state. And mm-hmm. I think that by DeSantis securing Florida with being a Republican governor, it kind of improves the chances that Florida will vote red for Donald Trump's re-election campaign. And so, you know, I don't think it's productive for us to look at this retrospectively and think, you know, even though I favored Gillum, I think we kind of have to remain optimistic about what DeSantis can bring to the state and how that's going to affect elections moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the only way we can look at it,
right,
since he is the governor. So we need to look at what can he do. And talking about amendments, though, Jackson, that made me think of, what was it, Amendment 4, that gave felons.
Right.
Yeah. So that, I think we could talk about that. That gave felons the right to vote. Passed the restoration of voting to them, convicted felons except for what, murder and sexual charges. How'd you feel about that? What do you think? I mean, should they? I've heard a lot of people still opposing that, even though it was. But it seems to me, if you've done the crime and you've paid the time and you've paid your restitution, then you should be allowed to vote.
Yeah.
And I don't know, but I'd like to, you know, tap into you all.
I personally think it's a great thing, because mm-hmm. voting, especially in today's society, is something that's sort of a God-given right. Mm-hmm. Most people around the world have this right to vote in their governments, although I will say that some people don't in some mm-hmm. countries. But, yeah, if you've done a crime, like you said, if you've done a crime, you've done your time in jail, you've actually felt remorseful, or you've done the punishment that you received for doing the crime, then I think your voice should not be taken away. Because at the end, if everything's stripped away from that person, their voice is still there. And if they can't even use that, then in my eye, then they're not even a person at that point.
I agree. Definitely, this is part of a very old legislation that's very common in a lot of southern states. You have disproportionately more African Americans mm-hmm. and minorities who tend to be felons. So this is very old historically legislation to prevent minorities from voting.
I think it's
a very good thing that it's been passed. And I think it's going to have a lot of implications in future elections, at least in the state of Florida.
Yeah, I agree with Jackson, definitely. A lot of the ideas that put those laws into place in the first place, you know, were very racially motivated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that us allowing criminals to vote in our system is one way to diversify our political scale. And I think, you know, we're in a very polarized climate right now. And one way of solving polarization problems within the country and within the state is adding new voting populace. You know, with new voters, we don't always get more of one party. We get more ideas, which is more important, and we get more voices that contribute to our state as a whole.
Anything else at the state level that you think we need to address?
Well, I'll just say, adding on to that amendment for a lot of politicians, a lot of get out the vote organizations talk about how you need to get out, you need to get out and vote. But I've never really seen them up front support this amendment, because that'll most likely increase voter turnout. And this amendment is actually an amazing way to do that in every state.
Well, you know, a lot of times they don't want to increase voter turnout simply because they really don't, even though you talked about it being a way to diversify, they don't want to diversify. If you're talking about a population that is particularly minority, African American, historically they are going to vote Democratic. Mm-hmm. And if you're in a Republican state, then it would be to your advantage for them not to vote.
Same thing goes for the debate on how the voting age should be lowered to 16. Most people from the younger generation tend to vote Democratic. Mm-hmm. That's something that a lot of Democrats support, but Republicans don't support.
Right.
Yeah, there's only one state in the United States, I believe, that in which the youth tend to be more Republican. I believe that is Kentucky. So.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. All right. Okay. Anything else at the state level?
No.
Okay. Well, we'll move on to the national level. I'm sure you all have plenty of things there. I'll save mine, and I'll let you all start, and we'll go around.
Well, definitely one thing we can talk about is the migrant caravan. You know, they're at the border right now.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of crazy that not only did Trump call the military to approach the border, but the president doesn't reserve the right to enable the military to take action. So I think that's one thing we can talk about the dilemma of.
Okay. Comments?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. I think, I mean, it follows this platform. It's a show of force. Legally, the United States Army, the people stationed there, are not allowed to interfere unless it is in protection of Border Patrol or police lives. So unless there is violence from immigrants towards border police, that's the only reason they should be interfering. But recently, this past week, I believe, a group of immigrants attempted to cross the border, forced their way across, because they felt the asylum wasn't being given to them quick enough, and they were tear gassed. Personally, I think the United States should give more asylum out. We need to, I think, push more money into immigration. That's going to allow us to get more people through, screen them more effectively. But at the end of the day, I think you have to protect the integrity of your borders. So, I mean, there were rocks thrown at Border Patrol agents, and they did attempt to cross the border at a strong point. So I think the tear gas was justified being used.
Okay. So you think tear gas was justified?
Yeah, definitely agree with that, where you have your own country, you have the right to defend its borders. You have to take any measure possible so that there's no risk at your borders. And yeah, putting in more money into the immigration and border effort would help tremendously. Like most of the asylum cases, the people coming in illegally often come from low socioeconomic positions. So they really can't afford a lawyer. So the United States government can give them attorneys, but oftentimes those attorneys aren't very well paid, and there aren't a lot of them because they're not well paid, because they're not a good job to start off with. And really, because of the low reputation that those attorneys have, a lot of future attorneys and lawyers don't really want to go into that position, which just makes an endless cycle of even less and less asylum cases being processed through, making it a slower and slower process, to the point where people feel the need to force their way across the border.
Mm. And I know I was reading some research. Pew did some research, and they were saying that the United States has more immigrants than any country in the world, that we have 40 million people living in the United States who were born outside of the United States. And, of course, I think what Mexico has the largest number. But individuals from Asia are increasing. And, you know, the question is, how do we address this? You know, what do we do? I don't know if the, you know.
Yeah, it's a very complicated issue. I think when it comes to the issue with the Mexican border, I think it does come back to the budget needs to be reworked. I think there should be a quicker system of asylum. As Apurva spoke about, a more efficient system. I think more people should be let in. I don't think they should have to have a comprehensive understanding of American history. I don't think that's necessary to be a citizen.
You must have been reading my mind, because I was just going to say, now what do you think they are the requirements should be?
Yeah, exactly.
Naturalized citizens probably know more about the U.S. government than your average adult American does, because they're required to study that information just to be given...
Exactly.
Given entry.
Indeed. Yeah, I'm sure they do.
Yeah. I mean, and at the end of the day, a lot of these people are seeking asylum. This also comes back. I honestly don't know how I feel about this policy, but there are a lot of these countries with these issues. As the United States helping them solve these issues? I'm personally split between a more isolationist point of view, as in these countries kind of need to deal with their own problems, as opposed to, well, we can reduce the immigrant and the refugee problems if we provide aid in these countries. So I think it's an interesting question how we go about that.
You're tuned in to 411 Teen, a conversational forum for teens and other interested folks. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll return momentarily.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You tuned in to 411 Teen, a weekly program for teens and other interested folks. This edition of 411 Teen looks at politics rap. Let's continue looking at the national level and what's going on. I want to talk about the GM layoff. Okay, I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. General Motors laid off 15,000 workers, and they're closing 4 plants, Michigan, Maryland, and in Ohio, but 4 plants. This is after the taxpayers bailed them out to, what was it, $13 billion? Now, they have paid this all back, so I don't want to mislead you that way.
Mm-hmm.
But they are moving a plant, or they're opening a plant in Mexico. So you can imagine what's happening with, you know, the citizens here of the United States who have just had their economic security kind of pulled out from under them. What do you think about this?
Historically, this isn't the first time the United States has placed, you know, our corporations in Mexico. From a business standpoint, you know, it makes sense. People in Mexico are willing to work for less pay, and therefore it's a more efficient place to put a factory. I think, you know, a possible solution for this was if American companies were incentivized to keep in nation facilities. You know, we had oil in place in Cuba, we had oil in Mexico, and then it created, not only did it create anger in the home front, but it also created huge economic tensions with those countries, you know. During the American-Mexican War, one of the main problems that created tensions prior to the war is that we were siphoning profit by placing our own oil industries within Mexico. So I think not only will incentivizing these corporations to maintain within our borders help, you know, American citizens, but it'll also benefit the world economy. So
I'm going to disagree with you. I think this is kind of as far as our economy is progressing, production is not where it is. We make most of the innovation in the United States in the future is going to be in things like the internet and design and things like that. That's kind of just where our economy is going. I think Donald Trump's agenda and a lot of Americans' idea that we should bring production back to the United States is just – it's just irresponsible because I think that's just going to put us farther back from other countries. China produces a lot of things. That's where their economy is. In 100 years, they'll be doing something else, and another country will be producing the goods. I think 15,000 jobs, I mean, it sounds like a lot. There are 300 million people in the United States. I think closer to 320 million at this point. At the end of the day, that's not very many jobs. This is how the economy in the world is progressing. Companies... I think it's foolish to try to incentivize companies to stay here. It's going to hurt the taxpayer. It's going to hurt the government and having to incentivize this because it's going to take so many incentives. I mean, it's so much cheaper. There's so much less regulation, and you have to pay for workers so much less in Mexico and China and countries like this. We really can't compete, and I think it's going to hurt us a lot to try to compete. I think what we have to do is do what we're doing best, which the United States dominates the internet. That's where we do – that's – I mean, Apple and Google, these are the companies that are our future. So I think we really need to focus there. I think it's going to really put us behind if we try to focus on making more cars in the United States. I mean, Detroit's never going to make cars again. That's – we just need to accept that, and we need to put something else there.
Yeah, and their focus is going to the electric car. And the cars, just to elaborate a little bit more on what's happening with GM, and they're discontinuing a number of their models, and they're going to Mexico to focus on the electric car. Comments?
Well, yeah, I mean, the United States has had a history of outsourcing jobs, specifically manufacturing jobs, especially in this last one or two decades where we've outsourced so many manufacturing jobs to countries like China, where a majority of their economy is from manufacturing, where we pay them for manufactured, or we pay them to manufacture goods for us. And so bringing that back to the United States would, it would waste so many resources that could be put towards other things. Like opening up a plant itself takes so many resources from a company, then finding people to employ them, then paying them to manufacture. It really wastes resources that can be used somewhere else. And, you know, opening up plants in other countries, that can, you know, it has a possibility of helping out their economy too. We're employing workers there. We're employing workers there, and, you know, that increases the amount of people that have a steady income, the amount of people that steadily put money into their country's economy. And, you know, it's, in my opinion, it is a mutually beneficial thing that GM is doing.
Anything you want to identify at the national level?
I think something that's being not covered as much is the China tensions with China.
Okay.
This, I think, it all kind of stemmed from a lot of the tariffs that Donald Trump and the government as a whole put on trade with that company. I mean, sorry, with China. So there's in a few months, I believe, supposed to be a conference with China to renegotiate trade deals because there've been a lot of issues with that. But tensions, the stock market this past week dropped a lot. I know people who lost a lot of money. It's recovered since then, still not fully. But this stems partially the United States. A big Chinese executive was in Canada, and we had Canada arrest them because they were violating sanctions in Iran. This, I don't disagree with that move. They did violate sanctions in Iran. But at the end of the day, there are a lot of growing tensions with the second biggest economy in the world, and an economy that's going to be bigger than us in a while.
It's not going to be 10 years or so. They should be larger than us.
And I think the United States historically opened relations with China and have had good relations with China compared to other countries. Nixon opened relations with China, and that was very good for the United States. So creating an enemy out of the what's about to be the world's largest economy, the world's largest population. I mean, at this point, the only thing we have is a larger military, and we all don't want to have to use that.
We don't want to go there.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Comments?
I mean, honestly, in this situation, making yourself look tough, it's not beneficial. And as Jackson mentioned, there should be a meeting in what, a few months?
Yeah.
Coming to discuss trade reform, trade deals. Just looking at the background of how that's gone with Trump in previous negotiations, I don't think it's going to go that well. And, you know, something that he should really be considering is the position that the United States is in and will be, you know, showing ourselves as a tough, not budging, stubborn country is not going to be beneficial for us in the long run.
Yeah, I think a kind of overarching issue that is associated with this problem is, what is American identity in this day and age? You know, I think a lot of people like to believe that America, like the United States, is, you know, this huge nation. Like, we have the strong, arming, like, military to push the other nations around. You know, we intervene where there's other problems, and we send our troops overseas to deal with all of that. But this is kind of forcing us to open our eyes. You know, China is massive. India is also massive. You know, there's all these growing economies that I think we're going to see a huge shift in the role we're going to see the United States playing, not only as an individual nation, but also within the United Nations. You know, the United States is always looked upon to contribute to other nations, whether it's militaristically or economically. And I think as we shift towards what we're seeing, it would be more beneficial for us to be more internally focused at the moment. And I think that is going to create a change in the international scheme. So,
do you all really think this will, well, given the current administration, that this will cause us or encourage us to really open our eyes?
At least I hope so, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm just wondering, you know, just being real. Do you really...
Yeah,
it doesn't seem like our eyes are open on much of anything.
I guess something that, I mean, it's a good way to learn, but it's also, you have to make sacrifice to learn. Making mistakes is the best way to learn. But in this situation, making a mistake can be incredibly costly to us. So I can see that this situation can be potentially eye-opening, but I also see, like, what's the cost of opening our eyes to a more better agenda.
Okay. Do you have other comments? You look like you wanted to say something.
Opening the eye of the public is kind of, I mean, it's kind of, I feel, a little loaded language. The American public and every public in the world is largely ignorant to what's actually going on, and very few people know the actual scheme. At the end of the day, most, I mean, a lot of people don't like our current governor, DeSantis. He has a law degree from Harvard University. If you met him, he would probably be the smartest person you would know.
I'm not going to go along with that. But go on.
Well, at the end of the day,
I know what you're trying
to
say.
Agenda, so
he,
that's why he comes across like that. But I think at the end of the day, what it comes back to is electing people who know what they're doing and who are going to care less about re-election and care more about doing what needs to be done. Because at the end of the day, none of us really know a lot. We're not very aware. It's extremely hard to know what's going on. Even someone who keeps up to date doesn't have all the information. And there's a lot of information we just can't know that only people in the government will know. So I think our change in culture over time from being a superpower to not a superpower is going to be interesting. But I think that's going to be a very difficult change in the United States.
Okay. Any other comments on what's happening nationally?
Something that I see in the news for only like 2 or 3 months a year, something that I think should be talked about a lot more, hurricane relief. You know,
we're still suffering from it.
We are. And to the point where any new hurricane is like, it's so bad, like we can't, it's going to take us years to bounce back from it. So, you know, I'd like to see better organization, better education about hurricane relief. You know, a lot of people in, you know, countries like Puerto Rico, our own president didn't believe the death toll that we had in Puerto Rico. And a lot of the times the death toll fluctuates a lot. As time goes by, you can start off with one person dead to 1,500 people dead. And especially in people that have low socioeconomic backgrounds, they're not generally that informed. And not being informed in this situation can be a life or death thing.
Yeah. That's indeed the case. Comments?
Yeah, I mean, if we look at the damage done to Panama City this in the recent past, you know, we have students who previously went to an international baccalaureate school in Panama City that, in order, the only way that they could continue their diploma program is if they came to the nearest school, which was Rickards in Tallahassee. So, you know, the way that the environment affects the urban scheme is something that the United States is very familiar with. And I understand that, you know, we like to create an image that hurricane relief is not as efficient as it could be. And, you know, I think in some ways that's true, but also I think that it's really important for us to maintain idealistic about not only what hurricane relief can do, but for what it's already has done, you know. When the hurricane came through Tallahassee, we didn't have power for a while, but people were working, you know, 24/7 throughout the whole night. We went actually through Thomasville and Capitol Circle, and we saw construction people, we saw police officers throughout the whole night. And I think something else is there are a lot of nonprofit organizations that are working on hurricane relief in the south of the United States. As of now, you know, organizations like All Hands and Hearts have been sending volunteers continuously to Panama City and to Puerto Rico. They sent people to the British Virgin Islands. So, you know, I think the amount of money that we're pouring in for hurricane relief from the government is only a fraction of the hurricane relief that's actually being provided because of nonprofits and things like that. So,
any comments? If not, we'll move on to Trump and his position with the Saudis and the despite the Jamal Khashoggi murder, he disagrees. He says no, that, you know, he doesn't think that Saudi Arabia was, or the president was at fault there, that he had anything to do with it. And a lot of lawmakers are disagreeing with him. What do you think? How do you think we should handle this? Should the U.S. take, how should they handle their relationship with the Saudis? What about the Khashoggi murder?
I can see where, well, I don't agree with Trump on the basis that it wasn't the president who insinuated the assassination of Jamal Khashoggi. It's just that I can see from a business standpoint why someone would be wanting to ignore that. I mean, I don't agree with it being ignored. I think to the people who are responsible should be punished on looking anything that might be beneficial to you. But Saudi Arabia does have a history of investing in a lot of American businesses. And, you know, putting charges on their president, it can be possibly harmful to the United States economy because that much investment in major companies in the United States. I know for facts, a product that I use all the time, Twitch, it's a streaming service. Saudi Arabia has a lot of investment in Twitch. And Twitch really in the last few years has become incredibly popular and it's making tons of revenue and that's really helping out the American economy. And, you know, accusing a president of another country that's putting so much investment into your economy can potentially be harmful to the economy, to our economy. So I can see from a business standpoint why it'd be beneficial to ignore that. But also on a moral standpoint, it's not okay. If you have any suspicion that this person did it, then you need to investigate. You can't just ignore it.
Of course, we've been involved in murdering folks too now. I mean, that's my problem, okay? Yeah. We're so, you know, this is a bit hypocritical.
We've overthrown a lot more governments than Saudi Arabia.
We certainly have. And so that, you know, we're talking about, what he needs to do. What about what we've done? Mm-hmm. You know, so we're going to play police.
Yeah.
Over, you know, it's
just
very
the idea in the United States, we cannot fight a global idealized war on everything wrong that's done. Saudi Arabia has a ton of the world's oil, and we are still highly dependent on it. We cannot lose that. Last time that happened, Saudi Arabia spiked up its oil prices, and we had a recession in the United States in the 1970s, and it was fairly serious. You have to be very careful with dealing with them. They have a lot of sway over us. Personally, as an American, I'd like to see more and more investment into things like electric cars that make us less oil dependent because we are forced to work with this despicable government who does terrible things. other
like
governments
we
are
do.
Similar.
Okay. Well, I mean, come on.
We don't, we don't
what
have
we done with Lumumba? I mean, what happened with
we
him?
We don't have quite a recent history
of
Saudi Arabia. Yeah. I mean, in the past, right. in the 1900s, we did a lot of things. In recent times, we have gotten, I would say, much better about that. Compared to Saudi Arabia or China or Turkey, these are countries we have to work with because of their strength.
We got
to
come back to this. We are out of time. I'm looking at it. I'm getting the signal. But I do want to say thank you for your opinions and sharing your time with us. To my listening audience, tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. The 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Holyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Ken Smith. If you would like to participate in 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. 411 Team archives are available as streaming audio and as downloads from WFSU.org. Check us out on Facebook.